This is Pittman McGeehee, The Religious Nature of the Psyche, May 11th, 2012.
Tonight it's an honor to have Pittman McGee at our Young Society, and he received his Doctor of Divinity from Virginia Theological Seminary and was ordained an Episcopal priest in the church in 1969. He received an honorary Doctor of Divinity from the Episcopal Seminary of the Southwest, formerly Dean of the Church, Christ Church Cathedral in downtown Houston. He's currently a diplomat Jungian analyst and the director of the Institute for Advancement of Psychology and Spirituality. So please join me in welcoming our speaker tonight, Pittman McGee.
Thank you very much. At my age, I'm glad to be anywhere. Particularly glad to be here tonight and to be invited back somewhere. I was here with you, was reminded tonight, 5 years ago to the date, speaking. So it's nice to be back. I can be an entertaining speaker, but I have not come here to entertain you. I've come here to challenge you and empower you and authorize you to adapt a conscious worldview. The Russian poet Anton Chekhov, in a letter to a friend, wrote, "Consciousness without a definite philosophy is no life, but rather a nightmare and a burden." Consciousness without a definite philosophy is no life, but rather a nightmare and a burden. I like to substitute for the word philosophy, because that can be intimidating for some of us, the word worldview. The word worldview. The Germans have a word for that that is really broader and deeper and more profound than simply worldview. Weltanschauung, pardon my Oklahoma pronunciation. In small town Oklahoma, that's the way we pronounced it when I was growing up. This is among the slowest groups I've spoken. It's clear I'm not going to entertain you. And by the Germans, Weltanschauung, they talk about not just a viewpoint or how you view the world, but it's more ontological. It's more about being. It's more about how are you in the world? What is your value system? What are your attitudes? And how do those dictate your behaviors? And so we are, as a human organism, we have four cornerstones of our human organism. We are bio, psycho, social, spiritual beings. Bio, psycho, social, spiritual beings. And I've come here to help you construct, giving you some resources, some finer tools through which you might construct a worldview, particularly a psycho-spiritual worldview. Now, anybody who understands anything about a psycho-spiritual worldview and anything about Jungian analytical psychology would know that these are not separate aspects of the organism, but distinct aspects that finally, ultimately, if you spin them quick enough, one feeds into the other. If you're doing physical exercise, that's something spiritual. So we wouldn't separate those out so dramatically, but also to say we need to touch the bases with some consciousness about our bodies. I'll be talking tomorrow quite a bit about that. We need to pay attention to our psyche and good mental hygiene, our social lives, which includes our work, and our spiritual lives, which I'm talking about primarily tonight. To honor Chekhov, consciousness without a worldview is no life, but rather a nightmare and a burden. It's a blind dog in a meat house, just simply reacting to smells. And so in order for us to have a life that's active rather than reactive, we have to have some viewpoint out of which we decide how we're going to live our lives. And who decides? Who's the decider, as a former president said? How do you discern how it is that you're to live your life? The greatest freedom and burden given to human beings is the ability to decide. The word decide etymologically comes from the same root as homicide and suicide. The word side means to cut or kill. Suicide means I kill myself. Homicide means I kill another. And every time we decide, we have to decide for ourselves or for another. And by what criteria do you decide? What is your worldview? I think most of human consciousness can be written around the issue of authority. I know the history of the Christian church is written around the problem of authority. They were arguing in the Acts of the Apostles about who's really an apostle. The evolution of human consciousness, collectively and individually, is around the issue of authority. When the ego bears itself out of the maternal unconscious in a simultaneity with the infant being birthed out of the maternal womb, the question asked by the ego first is, who's in charge here and what are the rules for making it? Because the ego has basically two goals. The ego wants to survive as long as possible with as little pain as possible. The ego is a center of consciousness. It's the organizing principle of consciousness. It's a surviving organ, but it's an organ of time and space. It has basically three functions. One, to orient the psyche in time and space, because the psyche really exists beyond time and space and needs some organ of consciousness to orient us. And that's what the ego does. I know you're asking, what do you mean the psyche is beyond time and space? Where are you at night when you're dreaming? Consciousness requires orientation. That's what the ego does. This is May. We're in Seattle, Washington. We need our egos to get us across town and to pay our bills. A second function for the ego is differentiation, and that is to tell the differences among things and between things, and therefore to make connections. The earliest differentiation of the ego is to tell the difference between the infant ego and the mother. And then to be able to make connections, we need the ego. The third function of the ego is to identify or create an identity. Not only identifying in the sense of this is a lectern, this is a microphone, but to have an identity of oneself and to perceive the identity of others. That may be the most difficult and even limiting understanding of the ego. The greatest lie that the ego lives is, I'm all there is. When in fact, the ego is an instrument of the psyche for consciousness. And it has all kinds of things it attaches itself to in its evolution in order to survive. I think I talked the last time we were here about ego attachments and how they must be taken away. That part of what we do in order to develop ego in the first half of life is attachments, identities. Man, priest, analyst, on and on. Awards, rewards. And defenses. Repression, suppression, projection, all of those great defenses that we have for the ego to survive. And the problem then for the ego is, who decides? In developmental staging, from birth to age 7, the authority for the infant and child is parents or surrogate parental figures. Clearly, the decisions are made for the child appropriately, naturally, by the parents or surrogate parental figures. Surrogate parental figures can be older siblings, godmothers, grandmothers, aunts, uncles, maternal presence of a nurturing neighbor, teachers, ordained people. Even government can be a surrogate parental figure, avuncular Uncle Sam. So we develop then in the first developmental stage from 0 to 7, the authority for us is our parents or parental figures. They tell us what to think, what to value, how to behave, what are appropriate attitudes. In some very important ways, this is absolutely essential for the development of an ego. It needs boundaries, it needs norms for behavior, and it needs resources for survival in its environment. So in the first 7 years of life, the primary activity of the ego is adaptation and conformity to the norm. From 7 to 14, pre-adolescence, there's a slow, incremental, non-linear shifting of authority from parents to peers. So from 7 to 14, in a non-linear way, in a kind of a rapprochement oscillation, the child moves back and forth between looking to his parents for authorities and looking to the peer group. By 14, adolescence is rampant, and the clear ultimate authority for the adolescent is no longer the parents, but the peer group. That's why we as parents want to try best we can to provide a healthy peer group for our adolescents. Sometimes we have to change the peer group in order for the adolescent to have better mental hygiene, better developmental psychology, better environment. As I said, I grew up in a small town in Oklahoma, and if the adolescent was acting out, the wealthy sent them to military schools and the poor people sent them to the military. Change the environment, change the peer group. By 21, the world begins to look at you as having to take authority for your own life. And that is life work. Our demographics are a little off because of affluence and longevity. There was a very interesting and I think valuable article in New York Times Magazine several months ago on emerging adults or emerging adulthood, saying that we used to think 21 was adulthood, now it's probably 28, and that from 21 to 28 is an emerging adult. With neurological studies and technology today, the neuroscientists are ascertaining that the prefrontal lobe is not fully developed till 24. Now, the prefrontal lobe is the human brain. We have a reptilian brain, which is about survival territorialism. We have a mammalian brain, which is the second development, evolutionary of development of the brain, which is herd mentality. The mammalian brain is about identity in the herd, the flock, the pride, the family. The prefrontal lobe, which is latest development collectively as well as individually, is what holds what we call executive functioning. And that's ability to make healthy, responsible decisions around primarily two issues, impulse control and delayed gratification. It's impossible for a child to control impulses or to delay gratification. You know the saying, slow is Christmas? Because children just cannot delay the gratification. You never tell a three-year-old, now later this afternoon you're going to get to do this. They'll wart you to death about when can we? Delayed gratification is difficult for adolescents. If an adolescent has three things to do in the evening, talk to his girlfriend on the phone, eat ice cream, and do his homework, it's hard to wait to call the girlfriend and eat the ice cream and do the homework first. It's called delayed gratification. I can see by the looks on your faces that you're thinking, I'm having a little trouble with that myself. It's all life work, isn't it? Now, what I'm positing and building a web here is the issue of authority. And the emerging adolescent, probably now because of affluence, people don't have to grow up as quickly, and because of longevity, we have a little more time in our development. So probably 28 is more the demographic for adulthood, and probably closer to 50 would be midlife. We used to talk about 35 or 40, I think is a little older. When I turned 60, we had a small dinner party, just family. And I toasted my family members in gratitude for how much they'd meant to me, and ended my toast by saying, 60's the new 40. To which my son Pittman, who has, I prayed for grace and humility, and God sent me my son Pittman. He's a psychologist in Austin. He said, Dad, only people who are 60 say that. So taking authority for one's own life is a lifelong process. And it's not linear. Because you have to decide. Now, becoming your own authority does not mean that you become an anarchist. I think many of the structures in our systems are afraid of autonomy and inner authority because it looks like anarchy. We don't make our decisions in isolation. We decide, I must decide, ultimately I must decide and take accountability and responsibility for my own life. But I don't do that in isolation. I have mentors, I have guides, I have soulmates, I have spiritual directors, I have mirrors, I have therapists and analysts, I have all kinds of resources to aid me in making this decision. But I, alone, must ultimately make the decision as to who I am, how I'm going to live my life. I think it's a moral imperative, and I think one of the major moral issues for human beings is to decide what is your psycho-spiritual worldview out of which you make your decisions. Now, in terms of psyche, we have some understanding. And psyche is everything about us that's not flesh, blood, bone, and hair. We only make that distinction for didactic work, education, because we can't separate psyche and soma. I'll talk much more about that tomorrow when we talk about the ways through which we experience the transcendent, the body being one of them. Ida Rolf, the great physiologist who came up with Rolfing, said that the psyche is the body is a psyche in three dimensions. So that we are psychosoma, we're not psyche and soma, we're psychosomatic. But nonetheless, the psyche is all that about us that's not flesh, blood, bone, and hair. And so good psychology and good mental health is imperative for a balance among the four quarters of the touchstones of what it means to be a human organism. Spirituality is something that I'm not sure we have as good of understanding about as we do that there is a psychology. Spirituality for me, my working definition of spirituality is a deep human longing. Now for you Jungians, you know that's archetypal. We all have it. We have a deep human longing to transfer the transcendent into the immanent through experience and reflection upon it. Spirituality is a deep human longing to transfer the transcendent into the immanent. Now, I've chosen the word transcendent because it seems to have a little less baggage than the word God. We can look at synonyms because anytime we're talking about God, we're probably talking about ourselves, not God. Jung was very clear that we have a God image, which is far different from God. Meister Eckhart, the 15th century mystic, said the only image of God we must have is no image. We can't imagine God. And anytime we're talking about God, we're talking about our image of God, which is not God. I want to say from the beginning that I'm a Marxist-Leninist on this issue. Groucho and John. Groucho said, I wouldn't join any club that had me as a member. Well, I wouldn't worship any God that I could comprehend. And it was Lenin who taught us to imagine. So, we can't help but try to imagine God, but at the same time, none of the images are adequate. There is no comprehension of the awesomeness of whatever we mean by God. So I choose synonyms to try to talk about that about which it, we cannot talk. Here's the paradox. Here's the reality of doing theology. We can't talk about those things about which we must speak. So we develop symbols to point to the mystery. So there's symbolic language. But using words like transcendent, divine, sacred, mystery, those synonyms tend to help us have a much more room to walk around without some anachronistic, archaic image. Like the old man with a beard sitting on a throne in a three-storied universe. Or without any anthropomorphic image projecting onto the transcendent or onto the mystery, anthropomorphic images. That is to say, human images that God talks, God speaks, God walks. I suspect if horses have a God, looks like a horse. So rather than our being created in God's image, we've recreated God in our image, and it's a projection. So spirituality is like the deep human longing to transfer the transcendent, that which is, that which we long for, that which we desire to experience, that validates, brings meaning, transforms, inspires. That archetypal energy that we so long to experience, to transfer the transcendent into the immanent. Now, immanent is spelled two ways, I-M-M-A and I-M-M-I, immanent and imminent. One means indwelling, the other means near at hand. It is immanent, it is right here, or immanent, it is in here. So we want to transfer the transcendent into the immanent, and we want to do so by experiencing it. God is not a concept. We cannot conceive of God. God is an experience. The experience of the transcendent that we all long for. Tomorrow's lecture in the morning, and then we'll have a little workshop in the afternoon, I'll speak about the seven traditional ways that we experience the transcendent in some depth. I'll talk about experiencing the transcendent in nature, in creativity, in ritual process, in love, in our bodies, in suffering, and in dreams. Those are seven traditional ways that we experience the transcendent, and I will expand on those in the morning. For tonight, if we look at developmental stages, the problem is, who's your authority? Now, most of us have been exposed to or influenced by institutional religion. There is a popular disclaimer by many, appropriately, but I would like to take it to task. And that is the saying, I'm spiritual, I'm not religious. Because the etymology of the word religion comes from the Latin legare. It's the root for the word ligament. It means to connect or tie together. Religare, religio, which is the root for religion, means to bind back, tie back. So it presumes that something that at one time was whole or connected has been fractured or fragmented or estranged or alienated. So the religious function is to connect in order to make whole. As a matter of fact, the word salvation, its etymological root is salvo, which is probably appropriately translated as salve, like you would put on a wound to heal it. So salvation is about healing, about wholeness, not about some magical thinking of being delivered from some eternal punishment because you didn't adapt to normative behavior. We all have been influenced by some religion, and we have all who are Americans been influenced by American civil religion, which has very little to do with Christianity. And I don't care whether you're Buddhist or Jewish or Muslim or a Roman Catholic or Baptist, we all got a dose of American civil religion, which is basically an ego religion. And it is a toxic brew of Protestant ethic, Puritanism, and patriotism. So we've all been influenced by this kind of cause and effect religion, this kind of reward and punishment religion. And it is a toxic combination, and many of us have been wounded by that kind of what we call negative father religion, punitive, exclusive, shaming, wounding. Protestantism and its Protestant ethic, I'll give you a quick thumbnail sketch of the church history of the Protestant ethic. As you know, the Protestantism came out of Germany and Switzerland, Luther and Calvin. Calvin had a great influence on the Protestantism that became Puritanism that came to this country. Calvin believed in predestination. Now, predestination doesn't mean that we are automatons that are predestined to our whole life. Predestination was a doctrine that Calvin adopted because he was so confused and concerned about why some people would accept Christianity and some people wouldn't. So he began to think evidently they were predestined to. And that led to the term the elect, that certain people were predestined to accept the gospel or good news of God in Christ. Doesn't sound like good news when you hear Calvin talk about it. Talks about the total depravity of man. So he was asked, how do we know who the elect are? How do we know who the predestined are? So he went to the scripture and he came back and said, by their fruits ye shall know them. There became the Western Industrial Revolution because we want to produce to show you that we are the blessed because of the fruits we produce. Produce, where I grew up, were fruits. So fruits became production. So we have, the more we produce, the more we have proved that we are the elect and we are the blessed. Now there's been some good side benefits that have come out of the Protestant ethic. But also there are some great psychopathology that's come out of the Protestant ethic. I was visiting my son in California, driving back to L.A. International Airport. I looked up and saw a billboard. I think it was from an air freight company. It said, "We work 24/7. And I thought, I don't believe I would publicize my psychopathology on a billboard. What does it mean to work 24/7? Why is that a value? What about rest and play? Even God rested on the seventh day. Not even he worked 24/7. As you might guess, I work a lot. Thank you. I may take you on the road with me. He rested on the seventh day. You know, I work with a lot of clergy, and they are just indoctrinated with the Protestant work ethic. And the whole thing about my door is always open to you and I'm available to you anytime. It's sick. It's boundless. It has no boundaries. So the unhealthiness of the Protestant ethic, Puritanism, as you know, is sort of Protestant ethic on steroids. The fear of Puritanism is that somebody out there somewhere might be having a good time. Puritanism wanted to do away with human sin through rigorous discipline and punishment. And sin was defined by anything outside a specific structural norm. Protestantism. The whole idea that God was an American and spoke English has always been, I think most Americans think God spoke Elizabethan English. The hubris of patriotism, that we are the greatest land of all and that we are the blessed. I grew up in small town Oklahoma. It's the third time I've reminded you of that. I must have some complex around it. Every Christmas in a small town, the Chamber of Commerce put on a Christmas parade. One year when I was in grade school, one of the floats, which was a cake made out of Kleenex tissue paper flowers and blue ones dyed such for dressing or icing. So this cake was rolling down the street, and periodically the cake top would open, out of which would jump Santa Claus. And the cake said, "Happy birthday, Jesus." There's American civil religion all in a moment. Our primary image of God is Santa Claus. Reward and punishment. If you follow all the rules, keep your underwear clean, do everything your mother and dad tell you, adapt and conform to the norm, then you will get rewarded. But you better not pout, you better not cry. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. I mean, what kind of thing is that? That's like praying that I don't die in the night, you know? If I should die before I wake, why would you put that fear into a child? So that whole idea that if you're good, you get rewarded, and if you're bad, you get punished, the whole idea that play and celebration is frivolous and doesn't contribute to the overall production that's necessary in order to prove we're the chosen. All of that toxicity is in each of us in some form if we're Americans. But it has nothing to do with spirituality. It has nothing to do actually with Christianity or religion as far as I'm concerned. Religion is about healing. Religion is about wholeness. And our myths and our symbols are resources to help empower our healing and wholeness. Now, you do know that we project, and we project archetypes, and the two primary archetypes that we project are mother and father. Those probably are the two primary archetypes. This is not a lecture on archetypes, but if I was lecturing on archetypes, I would proclaim that I think there are basically two archetypes. And every other kinds of archetype that we experience as image is a derivation off of those two. I think the two archetypal images are union and separation. And I think that mother is about union and father is about separation. Union separation is sort of the rhyme and rhythm of the universe. I mean, we see it in mitosis, that in the sperm fertilizing the ovum, union, and immediately there's separation, and then reunion, and then separation, and reunion. Life, death, new life, beginnings, end, new beginnings, creation, destruction, recreation, on and on is the rhyme and rhythm of the universe. That's the heartbeat of the universe. That's the beat of the dance of the universe, is beginning and end, separation, union, reunion. That's the dance. Now, father and mother, then, are principles that we have in each of us that we must experience in order to have the human experience, in order to become conscious, in order to be individuating, in order to become whole. We literally would not survive without a mother. Now, the mother archetype has to do primarily with connectedness, relatedness, nurture, containment. Containment is one that people don't quite understand, but I think it's a very important part of the mother archetype. Now, if you're wondering what the hell I'm talking about, I'm trying to build for you what we've projected onto Mother Church, that we've projected onto the church or onto religious institutions, the archetype of mother. And the archetype of mother has to do with nurture, connectedness, relatedness, receptivity, adaptation, all those wonderful connecting principles, and containment. And containment comes from the idea that mother first brought us security in the womb. There was no more secure time, preconscious, when we're in what Eric Neumann calls the uroboric state. The uroboros is that snake that is eating its own tail. I used to think that that was a symbol of what it's like to be dean of a large cathedral in downtown Houston, that I was eating my own self up in a vicious cycle. But when I got my Jungian training, I was told, no, the uroboros is a self-contained system. So in the womb, we are a self-contained system in a symbiosis with mother, and she's provided this incredible shock absorber Brinks truck for us, and we never get over it. We are looking for containment, that feeling of security, of safety. My two daughters-in-law and the birth of their children have come out of the prenatal training courses, and they swaddle their children in a most fabulous way with these swaddling blankets, and they literally put them in a papoose, which is the recreation of the womb. So the maternal principle of connecting, relating, nurture, and containment is essential. We all need that. It's archetypal. We even call our offices, our studies, our consulting rooms, the analytic container. So what I do, so much of my work, is maternal. Nurture, containment. Now, it's archetypal in each of us to have a mother. It is so strong that we'll try to make a mother out of anything. And we project that archetype onto all kinds of things. We have Mother Church, obviously. We also have the university, Alma Mater, our mother. The largest Roman Catholic institution, I mean the most popular Roman Catholic institution in this country, is Notre Dame. That's our mother, our lady. When I grew up, the telephone company was called Ma Bell. Now, those poor little rhesus monkeys tried to make mothers out of those wire frames with towels on them. And I'm going to tell you another thing. Trust me on this one. I'm a mental health professional. No, I'm serious. And this is cutting-edge material. Some men try to make a mother out of their wives. You heard it here first. Did you know some men call their wives mother? Amazing. So we have this archetypal desire or longing for a mother our whole lives. We always want that nurture. We want that warm, nurturing milk, that comfort, food. The first time we felt pain, do you know what satiated that pain? Milk. Mother's milk. Nurse and nurture all come from the same root. And our longing for and seeking the mother, that mother nurture, that comfort and containment is a lifelong process. That's what comfort food is, isn't it? Comfort food's all white. Bread, pasta, ice cream. Somebody said to me in a lecture, well, what about meatloaf? And I said, no, it's the mashed potatoes. It's interesting that comfort food is white. So our first experience with mother is when we hurt, we want mother to nurture us and take care of us. And we look outside ourselves for that, and so we project that onto the church, and we expect her to take care of us, to love us. Well, I'm here to tell you, that's just not going to happen. The church doesn't have the ability to love somebody. Individuals within the church do, but the church is not going to take care of you. There's an old saying in the church that the church shoots its wounded. I never understood, as long as I was a priest of the church, why in the world we would ever excommunicate somebody. Excommunicate says you can't eat here. That's really a part of the negative father, which I'm moving laboriously toward. The idea of excluding somebody and punishing somebody is the dark side of the church has never owned. So back to the mother archetype or mother church, the dark side of mother or the dark side of any eros, eros is a non-rational desire to connect, relate, or create. Eros is a non-rational desire to connect, relate, or create. So eros is that rich form of love. I have a new book out called The Paradox of Love in which I talk about eros, philia, and agape. Talk about mother love, father love, other love, and self-love. In any case, the dark side of eros and the dark side of the mother archetype is consumption or infantilization. Keeping the child dependent upon the mother, not allowing the child to grow up, consuming through that possessive love. My grandmother, God rest her soul, adored me. And as she used to say, Pittman, you're so sweet I could eat you with a spoon. Think about that for a minute. It's cannibalism. Now, she was the sweetest nurturer I ever had, but there is that side of the consuming mother, the devouring mother, and the church does that. The church devours. It infantilizes, keeps people dependent, doesn't empower people. And so as we talk about a healthy spirituality, we've got to understand that whatever your tradition is, there is some projection of the mother archetype onto the institution or members of that institution. Now, the father archetype, the energy of the father archetype has two primary functions. One is to civilize, and the other is to empower. If you just took one word for the masculine archetype and one word for the feminine archetype nurture, and the father archetype or the masculine archetype would be power. Now, it's very easy, and I do it all the time. Jung did it. It's just a part of the difficulty in talking about these things. These concepts, archetypal concepts of the masculine and the feminine, or mother and father, are not gender-specific. Women have masculine energy, the animus. Men have feminine energy, the anima. That men can mother, and mothers can father. They're not gender specific. They're archetypes. And the archetypes easily and very quickly slide into stereotypes. All women are not any one way, all men are not any one way. But the masculine-feminine archetypes are distinct. So the masculine archetype, in terms of civilizing, is that the masculine archetype, the patriarchy, has the job of setting the boundaries, the rules, and the codes. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, the patriarch Moses comes out of the mountain with the codes. Joseph Campbell, in his Power of Myth, says there are four functions of myth, and one of them is to set codes. And we know in the history of our development and civilization, we have to have boundaries. We have to have laws. We have to be civilized in order to survive. And I'm very conservative about trying to observe the law, unless it keeps me from health or individuation. Jesus taught me that. He was healing on the Sabbath, which was against the law. And he said, Sabbath was made for us. We weren't made for the Sabbath. In the apocryphal gospel of St. Thomas, he's sauntering along the road. He sees these men plucking grain on the Sabbath, which was against the law. And he said, man, if thou knowest what thou doest, thou art blessed. If thou knowest not, thou art accursed. In other words, if you're going to break the law, you've got to do it consciously and take accountability and responsibility for it. And perhaps a trivial example, my son Pittman mentioned earlier, when he was in the sixth grade, he had to have an emergency appendectomy. I'm a very cautious driver, but on that night when he was in great pain and the doctor said, get him to the emergency room as fast as possible, I ran every stop sign between my house and St. Luke's Hospital. I believe in stop signs. I don't want to live in a culture that doesn't have stop signs. But sometimes there's a deeper calling, and sometimes there's a higher calling. When I was a young priest, the Vietnam War was hot and heavy, and the young men who were choosing not to go because of consciousness, conscientious objection, fine to break the law, but you're going to have to pay the consequences for it and be responsible for it. So when we have a deeper or higher calling and we do break the law, we do so with consciousness, because if you break the law unconsciously, it's like Frederick Buechner says, there's a difference in being a fool for Christ's sake or just being a goddamn fool. Breaking the law is not something that we do without thought, without guidance, and without consciousness, accountability, and responsibility. Now, so the father sets the father archetype, the patriarchy, and we have, you know, the father archetype is projected onto the church. I've always laughed that the church in its history was mother church run by celibate old men. No wonder we're so crazy. The other is to empower. And the father's job is to empower the child. To empower the child, Jesus said, you will do far greater things than those which I have done. The healthy father wants to empower the child to exceed him. And so the healthy father provides resources for competence and confidence in the world. It empowers. The church's job is to empower people. The dark side of the father archetype is punitive exclusivity. Now the God image, the predominant God image in the Old Testament is Yahweh. And that's a pretty ruthless, punitive, exclusive God. You know, Jung wrote his famous or infamous book, Answer to Job, on how Yahweh came to consciousness in the book of Job. Now, as Jung pointed out over and over again, we're not talking about God, we're talking about our image of God, how it changed. God saw his own shadow. What kind of God would make a deal with the devil in order to test his servant? Now, that's for a whole other lecture, but what I'm trying to illustrate is that the church has a dark side that it has never owned. And that is that punitive shaming. My practice is full of people who've been wounded by religion. Now, I don't have a doctrinal problem with fundamentalism. People can believe whatever they want to believe. My problem with fundamentalism is that it wounds people and infantilizes people. Now, let's talk about this problem of authority for a moment. If the world or if life or if some part of me realizes at some time I'm going to have to take charge of my own life. That may be a long period of time. It may be a significant event that becomes symbolic of some kind of transformation, but it will occur to each of us at some point. I think I'm going to have to take responsibility and accountability for my own life. I've spent a life adapting and conforming to others and external authorities. But for most of us, for much of our life, the anxiety of decision-making was so great that we wanted some structure that would assuage my anxiety. And that's why fundamentalism is, and maybe always will be, popular. I think the reason it has some great popularity today is because the world has gotten more pluralistic. Therefore, there are many values and there are many decisions to make and many ways to be in the world. And so people get anxious because they got to decide, homicide, suicide. Every decision is life giving and death dealing. I've got to say no to somebody if I'm saying yes to myself. I've got to say no to myself if I want to say yes to them. Who decides? Who's in control of your life? Who's in control of how you live your life? Now, if you say, well, my mother and dad are dead, that's not accurate. You carry them around in your unconscious as complexes. And the voices are still there. And we are serving the complexes if we're not conscious of them. And you can't change something you're not conscious of. So we have constructed a worldview based on external authority. And in order to construct a new worldview, you have to deconstruct an old worldview. And that is one of the most difficult things for a human being to do. It is much easier to learn something than to relearn it. And most of us learned something about the world and our place in it that was not right. It was not accurate. Who among us didn't wake up at some moment in our life around some issue and say, they lied to me? To reconstruct your own worldview, I think, is a psycho-spiritual worldview. And the moral imperative and the moral responsibility you have to construct your own worldview, using other worldviews as resources, using other people's way of being as resources, but ultimately, you must become that true, authentic, autonomous human being that you were created to be. And you're the ultimate authority on what that looks like and what that being is in the world. Now, the reason I'm talking about the church is because the church has provided, in an institutional setting, a kind of misunderstanding of what it is we're to do, because these systems really are structures. And what anxiety wants is a structure. I want a structure that will tell me what to do, how to decide in every situation. It's hard to take authority for your own life. And the church, in my prophetic criticism, I have a right to do that. I'm a priest of the church. I've been in the church all my life. I've been ordained since I was 25. I have not left the church. I still preach, teach, baptize, bury, marry. all of that stuff, but I have a right to have a prophetic voice about critiquing the church. And the church has never owned its shadow, and it has too much gone into the dark side of the mother and father archetype and infantilized and kept people dependent and punished and excluded people who were different, who didn't adapt and conform to the norm, who were abnormal. And I think that that is so far from the essence of the good news as to not only trivialize it, but to contaminate it. That's why I got so interested in Jung and why I decided to leave parish ministry and to go back to the vocation I feel called to, and that is the arts of healing, teaching and healing. I do more priestcraft now than I did when I was dean of the cathedral. I was doing parking lot management, museum curator, fundraiser, putting out publications, personnel management, running a multi-million dollar endowment. I mean, I was a businessman, CEO of a large downtown corporation in Houston. Been there 150 years. So I decided to get back in the priesthood and leave the church. So I trained as an analyst. And the reason I'm a Jungian is because of what Jung wrote in a volume called Psychology and Religion, East and West, in a paper that he delivered to the Pastoral Care Society of London in 1936. When I was a young priest, I got interested in Jung. Some of you know the story that Robert Johnson was my first analyst and mentor. And so on my 30th birthday, some good friends in the parish got together and bought me the collected works. And so I was down on a Saturday morning sitting on the floor of my study unpacking the boxes of the collected works and looking at each volume and putting it up. And I saw this Psychology and Religion, East and West, and thought, that looks interesting. And then I looked in the table of contents, and it said, addressed to Pastoral Care Society of London. And I thought, I'm going to look at that. And I read it, and in there was a passage from Jung that was life-changing for me. It was a moment of synchronicity. It was a moment of transformation. It was a moment of transcendence. The transcendent became immanent in a moment through the vehicle of that written word. Jung wrote, "It is a difficult thing to model one's life on Christ's, but it's increasingly more difficult to one to live his own true life as authentically as Christ lived his." In other words, our job is not to become Christ-like. Our job is to live our true life as authentically as he lived his. And there we would proclaim and claim the symbol of Christ. And Jung said that Christ is a symbol of the self. Now, there are two centers to the psyche. As I said earlier, we have in consciousness, the center is the ego. Inside the unconscious, in a very difficult concept to understand because it's a paradoxical concept, is the call the self. The self is both essence and totality. It is the essence of who you are, and at the same time, it's all of who you are. It's the center and circumference of psyche, the self. The self, Jung said, is the imago Dei in the human psyche. The image of God is now here. Jung wrote that at the precession of the change in the astrological sign from Pisces to Aquarius, a new age dawned. He got that term from Blake, and it was picked up now to talk about a new age we're in. And he wasn't talking about chimes and crystals in Sedona, Arizona. He was talking about a new consciousness, and that's the consciousness of individuation. He said at the change of the sign from the fish, which was the age of Christianity, to the Aquarian age, the dawning of the age of Aquarius, that the God image fell out of heaven into the human psyche. And that is what he called the self, that each of us carries within us this image of God. And he said it's not exclusive to Christianity, that it's the Buddha nature for Buddhism. In Hinduism, it's the Atman, as contrasted to the Brahman. Now, let's continue to just deepen a little bit our concept of the self. For the ego, life is generated from the outside in. My attachments, my accomplishments, my achievements, my relationships, there's a kind of incumbent codependency of the ego. Codependency, my quick definition of codependency, like everything else psychologically, once it gets popularized, it becomes a mile wide and an inch deep. But codependency is, I expect you to generate life for me. That the generator of my life is external. It's like when we have a hurricane and we lose electricity, we have a generator outside the house that generates life. We're codependent on that. I mean, maybe in a moment of passion, if you say to somebody, I couldn't live without you, that might be romantic, but if, once again, like my grandmother, if you take literally what that means, that's what the mushroom says to the tree. I can't live without you. It's codependency, symbiosis, parasitic, sucking life. The ego has a tendency to do that. The self is the generator of life. What happens to us in midlife is that we're put in a metaphorical intensive care unit. And all of these support systems that are external that have been generating life for us are slowly unplugged. The things that used to generate life for us just don't do that anymore. You know, the degrees that I've accomplished, the titles, the mortgage, the cars, the kids, the marriage, all of those things begin to lose their energy. And they don't generate life anymore. And so the divine healer looks down on this patient in the intensive care unit as all of these life support systems are being unplugged and prays that the patient will begin to generate life from the inside out. The generator of that life is the self. And the self is its own authority. The ego looks outside itself for authority. The self is the inner authority. And the midlife transition is a spiritual transition. It's a transformation. And that the ego becomes subordinate to the superordinate self. It's not a linear process. It's not an event. It's a series of changes. Sometimes they are conscious and voluntary, but rarely. Accidents, illness, losses, divorce, firings, all kinds of things may begin the process of transformation. In the hero's journey, the hero leaves, goes on the journey of life, and inevitably hits a dark night of the soul. I'll talk a lot about suffering tomorrow and how it holds the possibility of transformation. And so the ego begins to subordinate and sort of croons along with Peggy Lee, is this all there is? Jung said the myth of the first half of life is the dragon slayer. The myth of the second half of life is the night sea journey, the interior move. And so in this spiritual crisis, in this transformation, in this midlife transition, as my friend and colleague Hollis calls it, is a time in which the self begins to become the inner authority. It begins to become autonomous, begins to become authentic. It begins to no longer seek to become an adapting organ to the norm, but seeks out meaning, truth, honesty, authenticity. Jung said, our job is not to make people normal. Our job is to make people authentic. Now, it seems to me that the true purpose of religion is to help people become authentic, to empower people as a good father to become authentic, and to nurture people and contain, you have a safe container for people as they grow up. A good parent gives the child roots and wings. And the church's job is to empower people to grow up, to navigate the gray world, and to be delivered from a black and white one. And to get out of the job of moralism, which is basically legalism, and the job of true morality, which is empowering people to become the true, autonomous, authentic selves they were created to be, and to be a resource for that. That's what our myths are all about. And so the self becomes that inner energy. Jung loved a book written by Rudolf Otto in 1939 called The Idea of the Holy, in which Rudolf Otto talked about the mysterium tremendum, the tremendous mystery, and the energy of that tremendous, I love that, mysterium tremendum. It's a wonderful synonym for that which we're trying to talk about. That the mysterium tremendum had a numinous energy. Jung loved that, and he said, that's what I'm talking about. The self has a numinous energy. It is a numinosum. And numinosity leads to enlightenment and consciousness, because the word lumen means light. Numen means energy, numinous. Lumen means light, illumination. Numen, lumen, numinous, illumination. And that the self carries that energy. The self carries the energy for generation of life, for transformation, change, growth, and integration. Of taking those desperate parts of ourselves that are separated off as complexes and to integrate them back into wholeness. Teilhard de Chardin said that the world is made up of fragments seeking out one another in order to make a whole. That's a religious principle. Religare, putting things back together again. So, in the psycho-spiritual worldview that I'm constructing for myself and sharing with you is a movement from authority being up there, out there, to down here, in here. And to claim authority for my own life. And then to empower, challenge, and authorize you to do the same for your own life. There's an anecdotal story told of a young cub reporter for the Sporting News. And he was sent out to interview umpires as to how they discern and what are the criteria for the discernment of what's a ball and what's a strike. So he interviewed three umpires, a rookie umpire, a journeyman umpire, and a master umpire. So he goes to the rookie umpire and said, how do you discern whether it's a ball or a strike? What criteria do you use to make your discernment? And the rookie umpire said, it's easy. I have a book. It has all the rules, and this book tells me what to call it. Goes to the journeyman umpire, and he said, I don't know. He said, I just call them the way I see them. He went to the master umpire, said, by what criteria do you discern whether it's a ball or a strike? And the master umpire put his hands on his hip, put his chest out, and said, they ain't nothing till I call them. That's the authority. Now, the church or structures or systems, just by their very nature, do not promote autonomy. Name me a system that promotes autonomy. The family doesn't, the rare family that does. Adaptation, conformity, dependency. I had a man in my practice whose mother used to say to him, Dougie, name was Douglas. Dougie, you were so cute as a little boy. I wish you'd have never grown up. Systems don't empower people to become autonomous. Family wants you to come home. Don't leave. Now, ironically, there's an archetype that is strong, strong, strong for us to leave. I mean, all the myths have that just sewn right into the fabric of our myth. You got to leave. You can't stay there. The fetus has to leave the womb. It's its nature. It's programmed to do so. I'm told by my obstetrician friends that the chemical excreted to begin the labor process is excreted by the fetus, not the mother. What a metaphor. I mean, there are three threads of individuation. They're all the same thing going on simultaneously. You have biology, mythology, and psychology all going on at the same time. Biology, you have to leave the womb. It's too comfortable, and it's confining, and you can't grow as long as you're in that confinement. You literally can't grow. And you will reach a time when you outgrow the womb, and you have to leave. And it'll be your nature to do that. Psychologically, that's exactly it. Simultaneously, that's going on with the ego. It has to leave the unconscious. So the infant is to the womb as the ego is to the unconscious. And let's look at our myth and look at it plays itself out. Adam and Eve had to leave the garden. That was the cost of consciousness. You want to be conscious? The beguiling one of nature says, only the voice of Eve, feminine voice, would say yes. We want to become conscious. We want to know the opposites. Because when you're unconscious, you don't know the opposites. Fetus doesn't know opposites. Doesn't take long. So if you know opposites, you're conscious, and if you're conscious, you've got pain, labor, and death. That's what the myth tells us. Farther along in the myth, poor Abraham was told by Yahweh, you must leave your father's house and go to a land that I will show you. Jesus is sauntering along the Sea of Galilee. You've got to leave your families and follow me. It's all about leaving, leaving, leaving. That's called individuation. The 2-year-old has to leave. The 14-year-old has to leave. The 21-year-old has to leave. We've all got to leave and go to the next phase of development. I suspect that part of biological death is that the soul outgrows the body and has to be reborn into a new realm. That's my poetic hope. Now, what I'm trying to posit here, ultimately and finally, is that for each of us, this is a journey of leaving and rebirth over and over and over again. Beginning, end, new beginning. Life, death, new life. And that a psycho-spiritual worldview expects that this is a dynamic, not a static, and that the structures, we're not going to promote our autonomy. They're going to try to keep us dependent. And we're going to have to leave that structure. Anybody who becomes conscious tends to leave the structure they're in. whether it's family or work externally, but more importantly, the internal structures that are placed on us by these unconscious complexes that say shame on you, or you can't, or don't grow up. A psycho-spiritual worldview for me wants to look at the myths and the symbols as resources for healing and wholeness, and for us to continually transcend the systems that birthed us, and that we carry within us, by our nature, all that is necessary for individuation. As Ed Edinger says, we have all the resources we need to individuate, and it will take all of them. And one of the resources we have is religion. As I've tried to work a new construct tonight. And that symbol and myth can be, and this was Jung's raison d'etre, was to come to terms with the Christian myth of his father, and to reinterpret for the New Age an understanding of the myths and symbols of our tradition as resources for wholeness rather than structures that block our individuation. And that we carry within us all that's necessary for that is called the self, the essence of who we are and the totality of who we are, and that the self is symbolized in the Christian myth by Christ, who lived his one true life authentically, representing the possibility for authentic existence and empowering each of us to live our own lives as authentically as he lived his, and to become a resource on the interior, symbolically in the exterior, to become that true, autonomous, authentic self you were created to be. When my first grandson was baptized, I baptized him. My son Pittman has a real good friend who's a priest, and he came to the baptism and brought my grandson Finnegan a large Christ doll. And it had a wristband that says, "What would I do?" I don't believe that Jesus wants me to do what he would do. I think he wants to empower me to do that which is authentic for me to do. I don't think Jesus wears a bracelet that says, "What would I do?" He wears a bracelet that says, "What would Pittman do?" When I die, God's not going to say, "Why weren't you more like Jesus?" He's going to say, "Why weren't you more like Pittman?" So, I've come here tonight not to entertain you, but to challenge you, to empower you, and to authorize you to become your own authority and to become that true, authentic, autonomous human being you were created to be. Let's take about a 10 or 15 minute break and come back and we'll talk. I was asked at the break if I had done any writing on this, and I have. I have a book out called The Invisible Church, Finding Spirituality Where You Are, and this lecture is based on that book. It's published by Prager Press, and you can get it on Amazon. I actually have four books out. The first one is on this very subject I was talking about tonight. The second one is co-authored by a neuroscientist in the Houston Medical Center named Blair Justice. And he and I wrote a book together called Raising Lazarus, The Science of Soul. And it was about his analysis with me and how symbol and myth work to potentially change neural patterns in the brain, and how therapy or analysis can change brain pattern. The third book I wrote is a book of sermons that I did at the cathedral called Words Made Flesh, and they are provocative sermons. And the fourth book is a new one, came out in January. Bright Sky Press did a book, published my book, The Paradox of Love, which is a Jungian perspective on the life's greatest mystery. And those are all available on Amazon if you're interested. I was asked at the break to sort of expand a little on the idea of Puritanism, Protestant ethic, and patriotism, particularly around patriotism. Where I grew up, and there was not an Episcopal church, and so we went to a little Methodist church. And right as the offering was brought up, they would bring the American flag out and sing America as a part of the service. And the sort of implication is that the flag and the cross have equal value. And so there, you hear a lot of fundamentalist preachers who are preaching family values and government sort of priority in people's lives. And so there's just a lot of militaristic, patriotic tradition in the American church. And didn't we all grow up singing Onward Christian Soldiers? So that was kind of what I was talking about, that there's a kind of implicit patriotism that goes on in that American civil religion. So what other questions or responses do you have to my lecturer? Yes, please.
I was kind of curious about the statement that you said that generally systems, social systems, structures don't really encourage autonomy.
Right.
And that sounds like a really good statement and everything, but it seems kind of to have this unresolvable tension, you know, within it. Like, if people did realize the truth of what you're saying, then wouldn't that typically just destabilize all this, you know, a lot of the systems if they all of a sudden decided, hey, I need autonomy, and then we left the system, whether it be a marriage or or a family or a job, wouldn't that effectively destabilize, you know, a lot of things and then create a lot of, you know, a lot of chaos?
I hope. That would be my...
Yeah, people leaving their marriage and...
Yeah, right.
Not
yeah. Sounds like a good idea to me. No, I'm being a little flip with you. I'm not particularly worried about that happening. But number two, I did say that when individuals become conscious, it's a threat to the structure they're in. And there's an old saying about in a marriage, if one partner gets therapy and the other doesn't, it'll change the system, change the structure. A lot of people who get into analysis, I've just had it happen over and over again, wind up leaving their jobs. Yeah. Because they have adapted and conformed. I'll give you an example. It's in my first book on the Invisible Church, case material. A man in my practice is a very successful, and by that means he made a lot of money. Because in this culture, that's what success is. He had been very successful as an attorney for a big firm in Houston, depressed, sick, burned out, wound up in my office. You know, great insight into the obvious. I said, well, what would you be doing if you were doing anything different? He kept talking about how he hated the law and hated doing it. And he said, well, I've always been interested in history, and I'd love to teach history in a prep school and maybe coach lacrosse. So I said, well, what keeps you from doing that? He said, well, he had to kill my father because I'm a third-generation lawyer, and my wife would die because of dependency on the amount of money I generate. I said, well, it sounds like a good idea, just like I said to you. Sounds like a good idea to me. Your father needs to die and your wife needs to be killed. Now, let's don't do that in the outer world. Let's do that on the inner world. Well, after we did a significant piece of work around his father complex and, you know, this whole expectation of what he's supposed to do as a man, on and on. He went to his father and said, you know, I've decided to leave and I'm take a job at an Eastern prep school. He did. He went to an Eastern prep school. And his father said, oh, God, I wish I'd have done that when I was your age. His wife said, I would do anything, I'd sacrifice anything for you to be happy. He had projected his own fantasy onto these people and never checked it out. So he left those both those systems. Now, he didn't leave his marriage and he didn't leave his relationship with his father, but he did leave the practice of law. So that's what I'm talking about. And certain people do, out of their own individuation, change the structure, and they see their job as changing the structure. Martin Luther King did that. You know, he changed the structure, civil rights in this country, on and on. So that'd be my response to you. Somebody else.
Can you say a little more about suffering?
Well, the etymology of the word suffering means to carry from below. Ferrer means to carry. That's a Latin. Ferrer means to carry. So transferer means to carry across, transfer. To suffer means to carry from beneath. You remember in the King James Version of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, suffer the little children to come unto me. Well, that means to allow it to happen or to carry them. Suffer the little children. Bring them up here. Carry them up here. Allow them to come forward. So to suffer something means to carry from beneath. So when we have an event, and I'm talking about soul suffering, spiritual suffering, psychological suffering, I'm not talking about physical pain, although sometimes they're inseparable, that the psychological suffering will manifest itself in physical suffering. We have an expert here in the room who can talk to us about that. He's into pain management. But on certain kinds of metastatic illness, to palliate pain helps a person to deal with the suffering. So I'm not talking about intractable physical suffering. I'm talking about the kind of suffering everybody has during one's lifetime. So to suffer it means to carry it. And to carry it means to hold it till you can find its meaning. That's where we get the word understand. You stand under, and an etymological application, you know that means now I understand it, and the suffering brought me a new understanding, a transformation of consciousness, found meaning. So that's something.
Earlier you said God is an experience. Could you give me some specific examples of what you mean by experience? I mean, you mentioned body, suffering, love, dreams, but right. Within each one of those categories?
Well, that's what we're going to spend the morning doing tomorrow. The spiritual topography is sort of written around the metaphors of nature. Mountaintop experiences, valley of the shadow, desert, you know, so the topography of the spiritual life is nature. So we have experienced so much of the transcendent or God in nature. And so that's what I'm talking about, and I'll sort of embroider that. That's creativity. You know, we are creatures in creation, and we must be creative. The Creator wants us to be creative. So when we're creating, we are experiencing the divine or the transcendent. God is love. Where we are in, and I'll say a lot about that because that's my book, The Paradox of Love, is written around that. That the experience of love holds the possibility of experiencing the transcendent. God is love, and those who dwell in love dwells in God, and God in them. Jesus said there are two commandments: love God, love your neighbor as yourself. So love is one of the ways. On and on and on. Spiritual axiom is that we look for the transcendent as the extraordinary and the ordinary, the miraculous and the mundane, and the sacred camouflaged in the profane. I'll be repeating that mantra all day tomorrow. And give me an example of the miraculous and the mundane. Have you ever been at the birth of a baby, either your own or somebody else's? That's the most mundane act. I don't know anybody who's ever experienced a birth that didn't think it was miraculous. So that's the kind of thing we're going to talk about tomorrow. Does that help? Yeah, good.
Well, why aren't drugs, though, among your list of seven categories?
Drugs? Well, I think that you're talking about hallucinogenics? I don't think that those are the seven traditional in the seven traditional ways. I haven't said these are the seven exclusive ways, but I don't think hallucinogenics for most of us is going to be our pathway to God. So I just haven't listed it. But I know people who have done hallucinogenics who have clearly experienced something transcendent and have been transformed. There was an article in the New York Times Magazine 2 weeks ago that they're prescribing hallucinogenics for terminal patients to help them overcome the fear of death. Because what I think happens from a Jungian point of view is the ego gets out of the way and sees that there is something beyond time and space, and people are not afraid of that realm. So I wouldn't disagree with you that that's one of the ways, but it's not one of the traditional ways. You could argue back with me and say, hey, McGehee, what about the American Indians? That's a traditional way they used it. But I would say for most of us in this room, we're not going to do hallucinogenics. Probably.
I'll bring some tomorrow.
Yeah, now.
I'll be in the northwest corner. All right.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.